Hello, this is Robin Collier, and welcome to Cultural Energy's show on youth, arts, activism, and the environment. Today, first we hear tips for teens from the Taos Middle School Wellness Center, telling us of the dangers of summer. Then, it's Isabel and Virgil Trujillo from Abiquiu talking about the history of Abiquiu and its connections with trading and the Old Spanish Trail. Now, Tips for Teens.
Hi, this is Tips for Teens broadcasted from the Taos Middle School Wellness Center. Today we will be talking about summer safety. I'm Caitlin.
I'm Jenny.
I'm Desiree.
I'm Brian.
And I'm Kenny.
In the summer, we have more time to have fun, but it is also easier to get heat stroke and sunburn. When you aren't fully hydrated, you can easily get heat stroke. One way to minimize this risk is by drinking a lot of water. Hanging out often at the beach can often give you a sunburn. So make sure that when you get out during the summer, you wear plenty of sunscreen, drink a lot of water, wear long sleeves, hats, and light colors. Have fun!
Another problem is water danger. You need to stay away from arroyos, rivers, lakes, and other deep places where water can collect quickly. Because if you're not paying attention, it can fill up very fast and you could be swept away in seconds. Another thing is that if you leave little kids unattended and they're swimming, it could take a little time for anything to happen.
That's very good, Desiree. Another bad thing is high altitude sickness. A lot of people come from out of town to visit our beautiful stuff, and they do a lot of activities like hiking and stuff, and from the altitude sickness they can get nauseated, headaches, and stuff like that. And if they're doing a lot of activities, they might run into mosquitoes, and mosquitoes are really bad because they have like the West Nile virus, and they can also run into ticks, and ticks are like bad because they can burrow into your skin, and they have like heart diseases that they carry around and they can kill you. Another bad insect is bees. Like, bees can kill you from just a bee sting if you're really allergic. So that's why all you people that are allergic to bees should carry your EpiPen.
And something I like to do over the summer is moshing. It's basically like kung fu and karate mixed into dancing with hardcore music, and it can become really dangerous. Like, me and a couple of friends went to a concert one time, and I ended up getting kicked in the head by the bass player. That wasn't too fun because I ended up having a gigantic bruise on my head. And a lot of my other friends get like black eyes and get their teeth knocked out from moshing so much. So if you are going to go to concerts over the summer, be careful, and if the moshing gets too crazy, then just get out of there.
Another important thing to talk about is fire safety. Some parents, when their kids don't have to go to school in the summer, leave their little kids at home, and if they're under 10 or 11, they might be making, let's say, a grilled cheese and forget to turn the burner off, and then that could start the house on fire. They also go outside and play with fireworks and firecrackers, and the fireworks could be pointed in the wrong way and land into the fence and create another fire. And some kids during the summer like to show off to their friends that they have guns. And their parents should lock them up and be sure to keep the bullets away from the guns and the guns not loaded.
Well, thank you so much for listening to Tips for Teens, broadcasting from Taos Middle School Wellness Center.
Double T!
That was Tips for Teens from the Taos Middle School Wellness Center. If you have a youth organization or student who wants to do their own features such as this, please call us, Cultural Energy, at 758-9791. Did you know that Cultural Energy's productions are supported solely by membership donations? If you like our productions and want to support our work, become a member of Cultural Energy, which you can do by going to culturalenergy.org. Now, Isabel and Virgil Trujillo from Abiquiu speaking at the Old Spanish Trail Lecture Series on April 11th. They are introduced by Lloyd Rivera.
My name is Lloyd Rivera. Yo soy Lloyd Rivera, soy del Valle de Mora, del Condado de Mora. And today we have Virgil Trujillo and Isabel Trujillo of Pueblo de Abiquiu. This organization
It's called the Old Spanish Trail Association. It's located in California, Nevada, Arizona, Utah, Colorado, New Mexico. And there's members in Vancouver and across the USA and even England. It only costs $25 to join. $25. Right now, Taos and Abiquiu, we have 10 members. We need to get more members because as a united effort, we could do a lot of things for Taos County, for northern New Mexico, for the state. There's a lot of needs. We need to understand each other. As Spanish, as Mexican, as Chicano, Genízaro, Anglo, African-American, Chinese, Vietnamese, all the different cultures that are here in Taos, in the state, in the Southwest, in the Americas. We need to understand each other. We need to get along. We need to have peace. We have to protect the valleys, the land, the pueblos. We need to protect the land grants. We need to protect Miranda Canyon over the ranchos. There's a proposed luxury home development that's planned for virgin wilderness out there. The old Spanish Trail ruts are over there, even across Taos, and the old Spanish Trail. And before that, it was called El Camino Real. And before that, Poe Trail, Pueblo to Pueblo, to Taos Pueblo, to Picuris, to San Juan, Okiwenge, Acoma, to Zuni, Poe, trade routes. Anyway, we need to work together. It's only 25. Okay, this lecture series is April and May, every Saturday. They're free, they're here. I want to take this opportunity to thank the library, the town of Taos, George Jaramillo, Ron Reineken, the staff at this library to provide this excellent space for these lectures. I also want to thank the Taos News, KTAO, Cultural Energy, who's doing the audio tapes, KXMT, Spanish-English versions, KFUN, Las Vegas, New Mexico. Okay, I'd like to present to you, okay, this is what we're going to do. Virgil will speak first, and then Isabel. Isabel is the director of the Pueblo de Abiquiu Library and Cultural Center. The old Spanish Trail crosses very close to the Pueblo and the church, and they'll be talking about that. Let me tell you one more thing. This series is a lead up to what's going to be happening the first weekend in June at the Skyute Resort at San Ignacio, Colorado. The 16th National Conference of the Old Spanish Trail Association will be held there. Some of the guest speakers are Aaron Marr, Sarah Slanger from the Bureau of Land Management, Santa Fe, Stephanie and Chris Rivera, they raise churro sheep, and from that wool, the Pueblo peoples and the Spanish peoples, they wove merchandise that was taken along from northern New Mexico to California. Trading woven merchandise from northern New Mexico for horses and mules from California. Very interesting. Anyway, so that conference will be held in June in Colorado. Okay, with that, I thank you all, and I would like to present our first speaker today, Virgil Trujillo.
Good morning, everyone. I'll say just a little bit of myself. I see familiar faces, which is great to see. I see lots of new faces. That's exciting as well. You know, my approach is I like to get engaged with the audience, and I know we've got a question and answer period at the end of the talk, but I always like to encourage folks to ask questions as we're talking along, because I'm a person who I am still learning all the time, just as we all are, you know. Lots of the things having to do with the old Spanish Trail, I'm also learning. But I'll talk a little bit more about, I think, Abiquiu and its link to the trail. Like I said, I'm from Abiquiu. I've been there all my life. My family there, its first roots, at least in the Abiquiu area on our Spanish side, is 1730s with land grants made to Trujillos along the Chama, immediately adjacent to the Abiquiu Pueblo. I have some roots and some history on the Native American side. That's always a little harder to track, but it's via the Genízaro culture, which I'm learning more and more of it as well. But first of all, I'm also an hermano of nuestra paternidad de nuestro padre Jesús Nazareno. That's otherwise known as the penitentes that some of you see, you know, in northern New Mexico. We just come out of Holy Week, which is a high time for us. Just with that said and done, you know, it's an intense time. But I guess what I'd like to say before I go any further is that we just take a couple of seconds. And in every culture, I think it's not beyond us to give thanks. And this morning, when I got up, that it was raining. Also, a person that makes my living, or attempts, I like to say attempts, and in many ways try to make my living off the land. In the Southwest, that's a challenge. You know, so out of our drought in 2000, I think we officially outlawed the rain, go away poem that's probably more practiced east of the Mississippi than west of the Mississippi, or practiced by kids probably looking outside when they want to play. Anyway, just a couple of seconds, or as we're gathered, just to give thanks. I saw the rain, and it's just so refreshing always. It's always a welcome sight for us who, you know, make our living off the land as well. Thank you. I'll talk about Abiquiu. Abiquiu is actually what I believe or understand is an older Tewa pueblo. The history that I'm more familiar with is what occurs after European onset, or after my Spanish forefathers come into the area. And Abiquiu has been abandoned by that time. But there's at least one individual, I believe Montoya, who attempts to settle the area as areas are being settled on the Chama. This is, of course, after some settlements on the Rio Grande. They encounter many challenges. And, of course, and I hope I don't step on anybody's toes in any way when we're talking about this, but I think one of the challenges for anyone trying to make a living at the time, or one practice, is, of course, probably, and that I think happens today as well, is humans' attempts to make a living, and sometimes at the expense of others, in whatever shape or form that may be. And in Abiquiu, you know, one of the challenges the Spanish have to securing safety in some of the colonies, is that they're getting, we use the word raided, or that's the word that comes to mind, by nomadics in the area. And that's happening and occurring in Abiquiu, and we see that in our history and how Abiquiu is, you know, the population is taking some hard hits, and mainly in Santa Rosa de Lima, that seems to be the furthest point north or west as the Chama actually runs through Abiquiu. And the Spanish government is attempting to find a way to deal with this issue. Many things are happening at that time. We also have already occurring at that time is not so much the encomienda system, but we have the system by which people are being ransomed, or that's the term that's used for our Genisaro captives, if you will. And you know, the Catholic Church is kind of the conscience of the Spanish government at the time. While many injustices, I think, occurred, I also like to look at the positive sides. There were some positive sides to that, too. I mean, you know, we have our faith, and we know that our faith, or in my opinion, is really good. It's our human weakness that draws from it and causes us to go astray sometimes, but we continue to work at that. The Spanish can't keep slaves, so to speak. So the practice is that you ransom these people, these folks. Okay, you come to one of these trade fairs, and that's nothing new. That's been happening throughout history. It is happening in some parts of the world today, and it's probably happening in our own area. And it takes a different fashion or a different way today, but it kind of happens all over. So people are acquired through this practice. They're ransomed. They serve in servitude in Spanish families and then are freed after a certain time, after that ransom is paid. We know trade fairs were occurring, and I would imagine it just wasn't woolen blankets and hides and horses, but, you know, there was people involved as well. These people have to be freed. And I believe it was at about 18 years of age, somewhere in their young adulthood, by Spanish law, you need to be freed. The nice thing about Spanish law is that you became a citizen. Everyone became a citizen. And that was good. Might not have been perfectly worked out, but it was good. So the government is also being challenged with these folks wanting... Now being citizens, also wanting their land and wanting to be a part of the greater community. And I will throw the word in, genízaro. And I'll explain that just for a minute. And some of you probably know this as well, so you'll hear more. And at any time, feel free to inject something you might have to add that adds to this. The word is a Spanish word. And it could be already corrupt of others. But the term, I believe, comes from Spain, the original term, or some words used are Janissary, regarding or going back to Turkish soldiers. I'm just reading more information that these were folks that wore turbans, and perhaps that has something to do with the way the word was applied to our Native Americans here. But it was given to Turks on the northern borders after the Moors were driven out of Spain, and they provided protection on those borders, you know, to Spain, so they wouldn't have the Moors come back in. So we know that they were providing protection at least. That's a word that is given to the people that are placed in the on the Abiquiú pueblo, genízaros. At that time, they're 100% Native Americans. These Native Americans have been brought, acquired, whatever the proper term might be, from many different places. It's not just one place. Remember, the trade happens everywhere. I mean, people were being taken or anywhere that it was possible. But the government being challenged by providing protection comes up with the idea of both addressing the fact that these folks need a place to live, how to, you know, allow them to attempt to be productive citizens and the such, and they're given a grant in Abiquiú. Now, our grant, it's Santo Tomás del Pueblo Abiquiú, okay? And as you know, Spanish gave a lot of the areas, a patron saint, you know, for the church. And many places are still called by that name. And Abiquiú, interestingly enough, sticks with its Abiquiú name. That in itself is a whole other probably discussion. You know, it's probably a crude interpretation of other Indian words. And I kind of never... want to know exactly just what the meaning is. It is nice, but a couple of the communities around Abiquiú have different interpretations for the name Abiquiú. And for me, that's okay. You know, they all fit, and it keeps things exciting. You know, some say Chokecherry Place. Another one is Screech of an Owl. The other one is at the end of a fallen tree or log, some to that extent. And all attempt to justify why the name. So that's all exciting. You know, I'd rather have probably more to work with and less to work with. But getting back to the Genízaro piece, May 10th, 1754, Governor Valdez, Tomás Valdez Cachupín, makes a grant to the folks in Abiquiú. And they're given the name, you know, it's referred to as Genízaros at that time also. And just a short foreword, after Abiquiú is ratified under the Court of Private Land Claims, after it's become an American territory, it's interesting that our patent, you know, by President Taft or signed by President Taft to the folks in Abiquiú, is written out to the half-breed Indians of Abiquiú. Actually, it says to the converted half-breed Indians of Abiquiú. So I don't know if that means we're not just regular half-breed Indians or what that means, but we're converted. I think it's just a struggle to really nail down what's happening in Abiquiú. And like I say, it just makes for interesting history in Abiquiú. As far as what it has to do with the old Spanish trail, Abiquiú is the last place that they believe there's European influence before taking off on that long journey. It was the last place, you know, where supplies could still be picked up. We also know that it was a place where some guides were also hired to go on that long journey. Some of them were Genízaros, as we heard earlier. Some of the, you know, the trails were Native American trails before anything. There was, you know, these folks saw the value in these people that lived out there. History tells us that they made good guides. We also know that other folks like Lorenzo Trujillo went from Abiquiú to California, then helped establish a community there. That's interesting because the Trujillo name, of course, you know, that's a family name. And the name Lorenzo, as you know, it's repeated also in our family names. It's not in my immediate family right now, but we have relatives that are named Lorenzo still. What's interesting to me also is that in the attempt now for the folks in Abiquiú to comply with their obligations that they've been given when they acquire this land is that they have to keep the Spanish colony safe. Okay, this land grant, ours is a little bit different. It was just not given out for settling the land, but there's that military or there's that other obligation attached to it. And I can only imagine, but back then, one doesn't have a lot of military equipment to work with. So one thing that's always worked, and I like this approach, it's called peace. You know, that's kind of one way to deal with conflict. Has some positive outcomes. And so you have these trade fairs that are created, and we know of these huge trade fairs that are that are happening in around the Abiquiú community. And this, of course, is by Native Americans and by the Spanish, too, but they both had something to offer. So then I believe that, you know, that's just actually a natural part of what's going on, and that's an extension of what happens on the old Spanish trail. There's actually a lot more to it, but we have huge trade fairs happening in Abiquiú. We've never been quite able to pinpoint the areas, but we have descriptions of, you know, the large grassy areas that lies around the cottonwoods close to the Chama River. Well, that could be almost anywhere along the Chama River in that area, because Abiquiú actually takes its, you know, the whole Abiquiú area is actually probably like from about Medanales north to past the Abiquiú Dam or Ghost Ranch. The whole area is called the Abiquiú area, but the pueblo is actually just on a bench south of Bodie's General Store, if any of you have been through Abiquiú. Most folks drive right by Abiquiú and never quite know they've gone right by the pueblo. But anyway, beautiful little area. I know I've talked a lot about Abiquiú and probably not as much about the Spanish Trail, but that's the part that I know a little bit more about. And it's home to me. It's the one I'm a little more partial to as well. Interesting things around Abiquiú also is we have an area in Abiquiú called Moqui. Moqui is an old, the old word for Hopi, okay? And here I lived on Moqui all my life, and it dawned on me to ask my grandfather one day what it meant. He didn't know what it meant, just that it's been named that forever. So we find out later what Moqui really means. And I had seen the word in old Spanish documents that my grandfather showed me, because it used to say, you know, referring to the little area, you know, the area in Moqui in Spanish, in the pueblo Genízaro of Abiquiú. All those words were in some of the old or land documents where land is being sold or traded. And I used to see these. And later on, we actually have folks from Arizona following trails or, I want to say migrations, but that's not right, of their people as they moved around in the Southwest. And then we find out that Abiquiú has a link to them, and that's where we get the word Moqui from. I might also just mention briefly that my great-great-grandfather, Juan de Dios Trujillo, actually was also a captive and was taken from Abiquiú when he was 9 years old. This happened approximately about the 1850s. It's kind of unclear. But my grandfather, who raised me, was also raised by his grandfather, who was Juan de Dios Trujillo. And they used to, he was able to share all these stories with his grandfather, which, you know, again, it makes me believe in how good the tight family structure needs to be. You know, I realize afterwards how critical it is or how beneficial it can be when the wealth of knowledge from a grandfather can be transferred to the youngest child or the kids, because here they have all this wisdom and they can, you know. So anyway, I just have to believe in the whole tight family structure. I grew up in a really big family and very tight family structure. I'm a product of, I always say, of my fathers, my grandfathers, my great uncles, all of them looking out for you and all of them having your best interest at heart. And it's critical. It was the language, it's the culture, it's your history. And as a kid, these are the people I can trust. You know, they're not strangers to me. I never even remembered having to. I mean, if I was watching out, I was watching out for actions that weren't probably great on my part, not at watching out for actions that are not so well from my grown-ups' part, which is really a good way to grow up in a small community.
You are listening to Isabel and Virgil Trujillo speaking at the Old Spanish Trail Association Lecture Series on April 11th in Taos, New Mexico.
Anyway, so he's taken from Abiquiú, and he's kept for 9 years. He's freed when he's 18 years old, and he's freed in a camp south of, well, originally, there's soldier camp, my grandfather says, used to be called Ojo de Gallo. And later on, I understand the name of the area was changed to San Rafael. And that's in southern, well, about halfway, not quite southern New Mexico, but south of us, That's where he's kept, and his duties are mainly hauling water up and down the mesa. But many details around that whole story, but fortunately my grandfather was also a very healthy man. I stayed with him for the last 5 years of his life, from the age of 92 to 97, which that was when he told me he wasn't comfortable being alone anymore. And it was a choice I made, because he had raised me, and I never heard him quite complain. If he had any reservations, he didn't let me know him. But interesting things, you know, there was an art, or I would say, or things that I learned about handing down oral history. And I didn't ask my grandfather always to tell me the same story just over and over and over and over again. But these were stories that he knew well. But I kind of had it timed out, because what I learned is, as he said the stories, sometimes he would bring in new details, and sometimes he would leave out other details, but he was really sharp. He was never far off the mark. And so I learned to bring up the stories again, see if I could get any more details out of it. But then within each story, one could ask also details about every event, even within the story. That's how I found out, you know, what his grandfather had to do, what his duties were, how he spent his nights, who kept him, all those kind of things, you know, that what did he eat, kind of what his experiences were. So I guess I'm going to encourage also, if all of us have some history we can share, hopefully we share it with our grandkids, so that, or with any of our children, so we don't get in this, what I call this identity crisis that I kind of see some of our kids, I think, floating around wondering who they are. You know, I tell them, I knew at 5 years old, I think I knew exactly who I wanted to be. Everyone thinks, oh, doctor, dentist, attorney, president of the United States. No, I wanted to be exactly like my father and my grandfather. That's all I could tell you. But I already knew exactly who I wanted to be. Anyway, getting back to Abby Q. Genízaros. Things start to change in Abby Q. We do, of course, have our church, Santo Tomás El Apóstol. We all often wonder why that patron saint was given to us. You know, he's the one that doubts. Of course, St. Thomas the Doubter. Of course, the governor that gave us Abby Q's name is Tomás. So we wonder, maybe he gave us a saint named after him, or he named after the saint. Or maybe it has to do something with the Native American culture and how we, you know, we're... I wouldn't like to use the word imposing. I know that word's used, but how we're attempting to, for Native Americans to experience what we believe in, or what my Spanish forefathers believe in. Perhaps that's why that patron saint's name is used. But in Abby Q, we still practice our Indian heritage, okay? And we have our fiesta the weekend after Thanksgiving, always the weekend after Thanksgiving. Now, that's not the patron saint's day. It's July 3rd, actually. And excuse me, I'm not sure why the day was changed. It might have something to do with busy schedules in the summer. But for one day out of the year, at least, everyone in Abby Q is an Indian for that day. Okay, and we have our songs and our dances, and a lot of them are related quite a bit to our Tewa tradition, and it, I can only speculate that it probably has to do with our attempt to celebrate, but the fact that we've lost a lot of our tradition, you know, when we've been channeled, you know, through where we've gone, that we pick up a lot of bits and pieces from the culture that's around us. Okay, so keep that day in mind. Another interesting little thing about Genízaro is, in fact, it's a Spanish word. It's not a Native American word. And we're not Tewa either, but we weren't Spanish either. So we're caught kind of between the rock and a hard place. I hate to keep using that. I have to find some other way to describe it. So Abiquiú for a long time is somewhat isolated right there in that little area. Sometimes my Native American friends in Santa Clara says, oh yeah, that's where we send the unruly ones when I say we're from Abiquiú. That's where we used to send the unruly ones. Okay. Well, but nonetheless, we're also encouraged when our Native American neighbors tell us one of our pueblos is missing, because Abiquiú was a pueblo. Well, we have, you know, we have enough evidence that it was a pueblo. My grandfather went to Indian school in Santa Fe. You know, all the kids did in Abiquiú. Actually, almost all the kids that were from the pueblo went to the Indian school in Santa Fe for, you know, quite a period of time. And then he tells me that, and this is all oral, and we're looking for stuff to, you know, information to back some of this information up. But he tells me that in 1928, la gente votó ser libre. The people voted to be free. And I used to ask, free from what? And you know, at that time, it's already, and he was actually took part of that vote. But what I also find out in our communities, lots of times, and maybe it's just our culture, we kind of go along so we're not as viewed as being against anything. And I often like to think that there was some not so good actions by some folks who wanted to see this change occur. Remember the way, well, some of you may have some knowledge of how some of the land grants were lost in the area. Abiquiú was not lost, because Abiquiú was an Indian community. It couldn't be sold off, kind of like the Spanish land grants. You were there 4 years, you actually could sell off your share and move on, okay? In the Genízaro, on the Genízaro land grant, you couldn't do that, okay? That protected it at least for that period of time. But the very individuals that were providing lots of the eyewitness testimony in the land grants, which were, you know, being lost left and right, were also providing testimony for the Abiquiú land grant. So we could already see a really nice practice on who was going to end up with a land grant, how quick it was going to get turned around and sold. If it didn't have anything really worth stripping on it, like the timber and several other things, usually that goes first and then what's left gets sold off. So what happens to Abiquiú? Immediately it starts to get into tax trouble after 1928. And we do have a little statement from the state taxation where Abiquiú's in default by 1937. And ironically, the first delinquent year is 1929. So that's kind of evidence that something probably happened in 1928. Anyway, the nice thing is, and it has mixed emotions, but the community rallies together, creates the Abiquiú Cooperative Livestock Association. Now, many people don't like the fact that that's the first name change Abiquiú kind of takes to, in an effort to create a cooperative to acquire the funding or sell memberships, is what they did, at $20 a piece to acquire the monies to be able to bail it out of tax trouble. The sad thing is many of the poor people in Abiquiú that were members couldn't afford the $20. But then we have an influx of outside folks who are interested in the land who can't afford the $20. So anyway, we're kind of caught there. But the real positive out of it is that we still have our land grant intact for the most part. And it's close to 17,000 acres, which the Sandia Pueblo grant was also made at the same year and at the same time, same size as Abiquiu. So that's a miracle for us in Abiquiu. I never hesitate to tell our kids, you know, this the Abiquiu grant is kind of a miracle given what happened to many of our land grants.
Who captured your grandfather when you said he was...
Yeah, you know, I have not researched that enough, but I believe it will not be hard to find out because we know where San Rafael is, and we know who was living there. And so that wouldn't be...
Were they Spanish?
No, Indian. Native American. Okay. Yes, Native Americans. And like I say, that's a whole other kind of a story or presentation. Because like I say, we had many years to develop that story, to get information from him. That along with just, you know, hundreds of other stories having to do with the history in Abiquiu.
We're called the Witches of Abiquiu.
Right.
Which weren't witches, but they were...
Which is another...
Padre's definition of people who weren't...
That's a whole other chapter in the history of Abiquiu. And I grew up within that culture also. And we still believe in that culture. We still believe that there are, you know, whatever they may be, demons, challenges, anything, whatever the correct term we might want to use today in anything, any community that we're in. But back then, very alive and well. And they were dealing with those issues as well. Thank you.
I'd like to present Isabel Trujillo, the director of the Pueblo Abiquiu Library and Cultural Center. And she's also a member of this association. So we have Taos working with Abiquiu and Abiquiu with Taos. We got to work together.
Hi. Thank you for coming. I just want to recap on that a little bit. Abiquiu in Santa Clara Tewa oral history says that the Asa ancestors of... came up the Rio Chama River on their migrations up towards Santo Domingo, Acoma, Zumi, onto Hopi lands. And actually, there are Hopi in Arizona that make a visit to Abiquiu every year on an annual basis, who relate their ancestors beginning in Moque, in Moqui. Santa Rosa de Lima is the chapel off US 84, it's chapel ruins on the right-hand side, right before you get to Abiquiu. In our feast day, which I don't know, Virgil mentioned the date, August, the last Saturday in August, Mass is actually held in the chapel ruins, and there is a procession towards Santo Tomas. Now, Santa Rosa de Lima was born in Lima, Peru, and she was a devoted... person of prayer and penance. She devoted her penance during the times of the Spanish Christianizing the Indians, and she didn't like the treatments that the Indians were being put under in order to Christianize them. And so she died at an early age, about 31, and lots of miracles happened after that. But one of the biggest miracles was that Indians flocked by the thousands to get baptized. And so she was the first canonized saint of the New World, and that's probably why she was the patron saint of the new chapel at the furthest most point of European settlement. Well, the continuous raids didn't let colonization happen on Santa Rosa de Lima. It was along the river, perfect area for planting and grazing. And then just a little bit further north is the ancient Pueblo of Abiquiu, which by that time had moved on upriver and was abandoned. And so the Pueblos, San Juan, Santa Clara, that is where they would send their Indians that didn't follow tribal customs. They would send them to the abandoned Pueblo. Well, those are the Indians that the Spanish would take under captive and Hispanicize. So we know that Genisaros were given land in trade for militia, And so I'd like to read a little bit of a memorial, Senate Memorial 59, which recognizes the role of Jeniceros in New Mexico history and their legal and their legacy, actually. So it says, whereas indigenous creativity and servitude were common in frontier society that became New Mexico, whereas various indigenous peoples, including Apache, Navajo, Pawnee, Ute, and Comanche, were captured, whereas indigenous people became part of New Mexico communities and households through capture in war, kidnapping, trade fairs, punishment for crimes, adoption, abandonment, and sale of children. Whereas baptismal records reveal that at least 4,600 one-captive indigenous persons were baptized between the years 1700 and 1880, becoming part of Spanish, Mexican, and territorial households. Whereas numerous primary source records document the captivity, presence, and experience of indigenous people displaced in this way, including marriage records, court cases, wills, and censuses. Whereas the experiences of captives, while varied, included being raised and serving within households and sometimes remaining in a captor's home for a lifetime. Whereas the practice of taking Indian captives lasted through the Mexican and into the American period for New Mexico. Whereas there were many terms to describe Indian captivity and servitude in New Mexico, including cautivos, criados, coyotes, and famulos, but the most common used prior to 1821 and into the Spanish colonial period was the term Jenisaro. Whereas the term Jenisaro derives from the Turkish word Janissary or Janissary, terms used to describe the Christian captives who, as children, had been forcibly abducted, traded, and trained as the nucleus of the Ottoman Empire's standing army. Whereas Jenisaro families could be found in various communities throughout the colony, including the major villages of Albuquerque, Santa Cruz de la Cañada, Santa Fe, and El Paso del Norte. Whereas in the mid-18th century, many Jenisaros were again relocated strategically at the edges of Hispanic communities, thus providing both the initial line of defense against raiders and the foundation for communities such as Abiquiú, Belén, Carnuel, Las Trampas, Ojo Caliente, Ranchos de Taos, San Miguel del Vado, and Tomé. Whereas by 1776, Jenisaros made up at least one-third of the entire population of the province. Whereas Jenisaros and their descendants have participated in all aspects in the social, political, military, and economic life of New Mexico during the Spanish, Mexican, and American periods. Whereas eventually the migration patterns of cautivos and Jenisaros paralleled that all the New Mexicans' communities extended southward to El Paso del Norte, Ciudad Juarez, and northern Chihuahua, Mexico, as well as northward to Colorado and beyond. Whereas the direct result of the Indian slave trade was the emergence of generations of racial and cultural mixtures, often referred to in the colonial period with terms such as coyotes, colores, quebrados, lobos, and mestizos, whereas many New Mexicans can trace their ancestry to these indigenous peoples. Now, therefore, be it resolved that by the Senate of the State of New Mexico that the important role of Jenisaros and their descendants have had in the social, economic, and political and cultural aspects of New Mexico and the United States recognize, and be it further resolved that the Senate recognize the existence and importance of this indigenous group and the presence and importance of its descendants today. Be it further resolved that a copy of this material, okay, that goes on to legal language, but. So we know that their trade for militia service also took them sometimes fighting off their own people. And in all this, losing their language, losing who they were completely, because their descendants are never going to be Indian again. When we read here that the Jenisaros can trace their lineage to only to this point. They can't trace or prove their blood to Navajo, to Hopi, to Tewa. We can only prove as far as Henisado. And so it is detribalized people. It is a lost community. But in my opinion, because of the language, because of the different mix of nations, I believe that is what allowed for communications in order to make trade with other Indians first, because they were trading before the Spanish Trail. They were trading with fur trappers and other tribes, and eventually allowed for colonization. I give a lot of credit to Henisado history and people. The people in Abiquiu are aware of their native blood, and many times have attempted to prove, because it is the indigenous that are the only people that have to prove their blood, and it's as far as they can go. I wanted to say that the National Park Service has designated 5 communities for funding on the Old Spanish Trail, of which Abiquiu is one. Guayna is another, Guayna, New Mexico, and San Luis, Colorado, and then it goes into California for San Gabriel and Aguamanza. So they've contracted the University of Arizona to do a study and interviews with the people there. And on the table here, you'll see 2 books here at the corner here on what their recommendations are. There's been one ethnohistory in Abiquiu, and that's the far right brown book there. It identified the people as Hispanic because by then, well, the blood was more Hispanic. This ethnohistory that's being recommended now is in order to give credit again for the Indian blood that was present. And so that is from interviews of the local people, and so that tells you that is what the people want. They want to be recognized again. They don't want to let go of their Indian heritage. There is a place in San Bernardino, California, the Aguamanza. There's a San Bernardino Museum. And so there's a book here on the history trail. We at the library have some communication with their museum because you can get on the internet and they have the entire cemetery, names and dates accessible. And so they say that 50% of their cemetery plots are people that left Abiquiu and went to California. And so the library is attempting to educate our kids through summer programs, summer employment. And so when we write our grants, we try to make as much summer activity as we can that will educate the kids about the trail, about the different things that are visible in Abiquiu, the different histories, because we have so much traffic that comes looking for Georgia O'Keeffe, who, you know, has been gone for years and years. And so the only doors really open to the public in Abiquiu in the Pueblo itself are the library or the church, but the church, it depends, days and times. And so the library doors are always open, and people come in and they want Georgia O'Keeffe's history. Well, we can help a little bit, and we have books and things, but there's so much more that we have to offer in Abiquiu in the way of the history and the people. And so Memorial Weekend this year, we've been granted a Humanities and a McEwen grant to launch walking history tours. And so we're working on the narratives for that now. We have some local historians that will train docents, and we will advertise and hook up to O'Keeffe visitors and anybody in New Mexico. And so Memorial Weekend, during the 400th celebration in Santa Fe, in Abiquiu, we will launch history walking tours. I have some pictures that kind of give an idea of the feast day that we celebrate, kind of give an idea of the way that that the attire is worn. And I guess I need to say that we're never really sure exactly how we've come to this attire, or even the songs and the language and the meanings. And so we're always trying to communicate with nearby pueblos, or you know, we're very inviting. I think Abiquiú has gained a reputation of not wanting, you know, people to research and come into the pueblo. But actually, Abiquiú is known to be the most written about place in New Mexico. And it is because there are so many origins in Abiquiú. So I'll put these on the table for later. I also have a picture here of during the days when San Juan used to come to our ceremonials, and pictures of the kids that we try to get involved in being new drummers. Because if you go to any feast day in New Mexico, there's thousands and thousands of participation. And in Abiquiú, it's very small. It's really dying out. And so we're really trying to keep it going and not let it go away, because it's that important to the elders especially. We're doing a lot of oral histories and things like that. We've also last summer took our summer employees' kids to the cemetery and photographed every single plot. I mean, very early 1800s, the entire old cemetery, because we have a new cemetery now. The old one has filled, and it's all in a digital archive, which was funded by New Mexico State Archives. And so over this next summer, we'll be making a virtual exhibit that you'll be able to view online. And so, you know, that's with help from the San Bernardino Museum and following their ways. This lady, Vivian Delgado, recently came to Abiquiú during the days when the land grant, being the first in New Mexico to receive back state property that had initially belonged to the land grant, 32 acres were received back this past summer. And so she came over to that celebration, and she's got this book out. It's new. It's called You're Not Indian, you're Mexican. And there's a chapter in here, chapter 6, specifically on Genisados. I have a couple of her books here if anybody's interested in that. I think that is it. Thank you.
You have been listening to Virgil and Isabel Trujillo speaking at the Old Spanish Trail Association Lecture Series held at the Taos Library last April 11th. This series continues, and this weekend, Rich Sanders will speak about unknown Black history, connection of Blacks in the Southwest to the Old Spanish Trail. That's this Saturday, 10:15 at the Taos Library. You can listen to a longer version of this talk at culturalenergy.org. This is Robin Collier, and thanks for listening.